Okay. Come, are we good to go?
Yep. So then I'd like to go into what you just said, Nisha, is such an embodiment of all that you are as a as an educator. It's been such a part of your journey. We were hoping that you could describe how you came to the university and how you go a little deeper into your process of deciding how you wanted to do this work in the world, considering the fact that it's such a special way of, handling higher education, how it's looked upon, and how it eventually led you to CAS.
I went to school at the University of Michigan. I got my PhD in the School of Education, the Social Foundations of Education. That department doesn't exist anymore. I think it exists only like maybe two universities in the country. Anyway, and then I became a teaching assistant over in the Department of Psychology, and I began teaching as a teaching assistant. I think I got a job as a lecturer in women's studies because they're looking for people to teach, basically, because tenured faculty are not always available to teach. And so I got a job as a lecturer, and I came back because I had left after I got my PhD, and I'd gone back to the Caribbean, where I worked in the Virgin Islands and then in Jamaica, and then I came back. Essentially because my father was sick in Toronto. And so I wanted to be supportive of my parents because he had Alzheimer. And so I'd come to Michigan, and I would go back and forth on the weekends. And so I just said, well, I said to Women's Studies, and they asked at the time, well, I'm coming back. I want to do this, and I can get a job to teach. And they said, okay, sure. So I think Pat Gurin was the person who hired me at Women's Studies and at DAS as a lecturer. And I remember, and I've written, I'm writing a book on the pedagogy of action, the project that I spent most of my time on. And at the time, I had written the book Blaze of Fire, The Significant Contributions of Caribbean Women, which was a book about Caribbean women in 13 countries in the Caribbean. And I'd written it in a way so that high school students in 1988 or something like that could begin to read about women, to begin to read women, both boys and girls would have to read about women and women's contributions. And that book, I did not write one chapter about theory in that book. I saw the book as theory in action, that when the kid reads the book, he begin to value women more than that particular way that they saw them. But the book at the time, when I was meeting with Abby Stewart, who was the person who was the head of women's studies, she said, Nisha, you cannot use your book to defend a tenure track position at the University of Michigan. It's not defendable. It's not defendable because it is not academically advanced. And I sent essentially because it didn't write about theory and didn't write in a certain way. And I accepted that. But in retrospect, I've come to think of that moment as very pivotal for how I've interacted in the university in the status as a lecturer, because I think lecturers have since then become unionized. But I think the role of a lecturer is a very distinct position in the university. On the one hand, it does all the front-like work in teaching, and the other hand, that does not get the rewards or the emoluments that people in higher positions and tenure track positions get. But I just say that as a context of my own consciousness of where and what I was doing, that I was not unaware of the inequality of the system, or that the teaching was not valued, even though the university says it is valued, but it is not. And so I proceeded to do that. And at the time when I started to teach, I thought I wanted to do the HIV module, which I had developed already in the Caribbean, of how to teach HIV prevention to low literate people. And the reason why I came back to Michigan also is so I could develop the module and then teach University of Michigan students the module and then take them to South Africa where my sister was living. And so the course that was born was the Pedagogy of Empowerment, which at that time was a very radical work. It isn't anymore. It's like a regular, it's a word that I try to shy away from now. But at the time we taught the Pedagogy of Empowerment and it was about developing the HIV module, teaching the HIV module to the community and then taking it to South Africa. And so that combined with the HIV prevention module and the study abroad were connected immediately as the method and the way with which I would work at the University of Michigan for the next 20 years.
Now, preceding the Pedagogy of Action, I distinctly remember that you had other study abroads that you took to Barbados. And could you speak a little about those? And Jamaica, yes. I remember.
I remember in 1989 or 90, something like that. Because I left the University of Michigan in 1992. So before that, I was teaching in DAS and women's studies. And I had started what is the first study abroad to the Caribbean, to Barbados. I think it was 1989. I can't remember the date specifically, but I think it was 1988 or 1989. And I did that with Evans Young, who was the administrator of DAS at the time. And we did it with the Office of International Programs, which at that time had almost all of its programs to Europe, to Spain, to France, and so forth. And so there was no attempt to including communities of color elsewhere. And so we started the program in 1989, and largely that was a program that I set up to sort of set up the Caribbean as a place of ideas rather than a place of sun, sea, sand, and sex. So I wanted to show that the idea was a place that generated important ideas that shaped the whole of the diaspora thinking in the African diaspora. And so at that meeting, we had George Lamming, we had Andai of the WPA, we had Hilary Beckles, who is now the chief proponent of reparations in almost the entire world and is now the chancellor of the University of the West Indies. And so the many important intellectuals came and spoke to the students in Barbados. And so it was really an exposure to them that I want them to begin to think of the Caribbean as really the birthplace of a lot of ideas, especially Marcus Garvey. And so that was critically important to me. It's really interesting, the last class I taught at the University of Michigan was a class on Marcus Garvey. So that was the purpose of the first study brought to Barbados. The next two I did were to Jamaica, and it was along those lines as well of introducing the students to really great thinkers of the Caribbean. And so people like Vereen Shepherd, the poet Lorna Goodison, all of those people who were in Jamaica came and spoke to the students at that time. And so they were exposed to really important intellectuals at that time. And at the same time, we were exploring the country and its sites that they wanted to see, which were Negril and the beach and all that stuff. But I wanted to make what was important the ideas rather than the tourism. But that's a very, very hard stereotype to work against, Elizabeth. It's very, very hard because it's really hard to shift Americans' view of the Caribbean, and particularly Jamaica, as a place of serious ideas, as opposed to ganja, as opposed to sand, as opposed to the sea, as opposed to come to Jamaica, man, no problem, you know. So, but nonetheless, I think the students appreciated, and very important students emerged from that project. I think Gina Ulisi, her dissertation emerged from that project. And she's now at University of California, Santa Cruz, and has now replaced the job that Angela Davis used to have. So really very significant things happened from that trip as well.
You know, that's got me thinking, how would you compare the one that you did to Jamaica in that era compared to the one that I visited in 2013 when you took the HIV, that pandemic?
Yes.
That's a very interesting.
I think the ones I did in 2013, it was good in the sense that we spent a lot of the time in Kingston. Mm-hmm. And I think the students were exposed to Kingston and so forth. But I think that because it was specifically focused on HIV and HIV prevention, they had greater interaction with community. They met all of the communities involved and vulnerable. So we did a lot of work with the gay community in Jamaica. But I don't think it had the same intellectual depth as the other ones did. And that's because it was structured for them to work in the community itself. So there were pros and cons. One had a larger intellectual depth and the other one had a more activist praxis component. But it was the one in 2013 had its own problems as well, as they all do in many respects. But they ended up really doing excellent teaching in Kingston.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I didn't get the same feeling that as what you expressed about breaking through that, the sand and sun. And
right, no.
Those stereotypes.
There was a lot of inclination towards that. And as you know, Elizabeth, knowing me, I'm very, very tough. And so, you know, I try to instill and stand up and advocate, but it's a hard stereotype to work against. Very, very hard. But we did some good work came out of it.
For sure. Great. Did you want to take the next question, Dolapo?
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Beth. She actually spoke a little bit about that. I just want you, Matt, to please expatiate on what impact you think the community members, I mean, where we took the study abroad programs to the pedagogy of action, what impact does it have on community members? You spoke a little bit about students. I mean, if you could expatiate on that, that would be better. Like, how did they impact with students and community members?
The pedagogy of action was based on an HIV oral methodology that I developed to teach HIV prevention. And my objective was to teach largely communities of color in the United States and, of course, the Caribbean and in South Africa. Because in the United States, I don't think that the idea of HIV was very present in the public's mind, that it was affecting communities of color, specifically African-American communities. Everybody thought HIV was a problem in Africa. And so one of the first things we tried to do was to develop an awareness of the issue in the African-American community and the Black gay African-American community as well. So I think one of the impacts that we made is that we sort of went into communities in areas that the University of Michigan would not normally go into. So for example, one of the places we went to was in Dearborn, working with gay Muslim communities. So in terms of the impact on one level, we accessed places that were very difficult to access, and we were able to do that and work in those communities where sort of on the front lines of the problem. So in Black gay communities in Detroit, we worked in the 2000s in those communities. So that's for the American community, and we've taught many people as well, many communities who continue to teach it in their own ways. In the Caribbean, I think we may have reached over 50,000 people because the module existed there for about 5 years. Because I developed it there, and then I worked there in about 5 or 6 Caribbean countries. And people continued to work to use it in their communities. But I think the numbers in South Africa are much, much larger. It's about 20 to 50,000 people that we have been able to impact over a period of 15 years going there. And so each time, I'd give you one example. One year we worked at Zululand, when we went back the next year, I think we did this in 2006, we went back in 2007, we gathered the people who are still there and had them each talk about what they did in the time we'd left. And it came about that almost all of them had gone into their communities, because Zululand is a rural university, so almost all the students were from rural areas, from villages that were very far away, where the HIV epidemic was at its highest in the rural communities. And they'd gone back and they taught their entire high schools. They taught their villages. They talked to their parents and so forth. And when they came back for that 1 year alone, they told us they had reached 8,000 people. And of course I made them document it. But I don't think they documented all of it. So I think it may have been 10,000 people, but what they say, well, we didn't count, but the whole school was full and so forth and so forth. So one of the problems of the HIV module is the difficulties in documenting. Because when you leave the community behind and give them, let's just say, a one-page paper to fill out, they will always fill it out by memory. They never fill it out on the day and the time they were supposed to do it. And so we have their recollections of it, and we have those documents on tape. But we taught in many, many places, in KwaZulu-Natal, in Gauteng, in Johannesburg, in Venda, in many places in between. So so I think the largest impact, though, was in KwaZulu-Natal. And that is because I focused it there because that was the epicenter of the epidemic. So we worked with the University of Zululand, we worked with KZN, we worked DUT, Durban Institute of Higher Education, and many other places and community groups, the Red Cross, churches, many, 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 many places that we worked in townships, in high schools, in primary schools, all over the place. And I remember we taught in KwaZulu-Natal in Cato Crest at a primary school there, which is in a township, a very poor township. And we taught kids who are 10, 11, 12 years old, the HIV module.
Wow, that's great work. Thank you. Looking back at 50 years of work now, what do you think you could have done better? I guess the question is, how better could you have improved, for example, the pedagogy of action? Like, what do you think you could have actually done better to get better efficiency?
That's a good question. I think if I had opted to write articles and do research, and I had entered into a tenure track line, or I had tried to sort of go to another university and apply to it, and then tell the University of Michigan I'm getting this offer, I think those things would have put me in a better position of authority, and would have accessed me to myself a lot more funding and a lot more institutional support. But I didn't do that. And I didn't do that for a lot of reasons. But I think I could have done a lot more. I don't think that I could have done anything better. I think I've tried to involve people. I mean, Elizabeth was involved in pedagogy of action at the time when they weren't allowing staff to do such things. So I involved a lot of people in different ways because I want the pedagogy of action to be an example of democracy, of enacting social justice inside of the project itself and out. So I involved Irvin, who was worked in the hospital in Detroit, who learned the module, and I would bring him back every year to teach the module to University of Michigan students. So there are many, many ideas that I try to sort of enact in the pedagogy of action that were really outside the lines of what one was supposed to do. Because the university would not necessarily want somebody to be teaching them in the classroom with people who don't have certain levels of certificates and so forth. So there are many, many things, because I think that the important thing was to allow the knowledge to be owned by everyone, and that not have the knowledge only belong to those at a certain hierarchy, at a certain level. And that's particularly important to me.
Elizabeth, over to you.
Okay. I was thinking about what you said, Nisha, about the whole funding issue. Mm-hmm. When you think about study abroad programs and you think about study in broad programs, how do you feel about the different ways that funding is channeled to programs such as DAS. Mm-hmm, you know, we've been discovering as we are going along, and I don't think it would be too much of an understatement to say that CAS and DAS have always had to struggle for their space on this campus. Mm-hmm. And as someone who has done such incredible outreach work, how do you see it being valued by the university? And just given how, you know, this whole sense of sustaining programs, you know, you were able to do it through a lot of what I call hustling. You had to do a lot of your work was challenged by these different obstacles you had to overcome in order to even make it happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just thinking the question that DeLapo asked about better, and the impact, but also we don't think about the toll it takes on us as educators. So if you could speak a little about the challenges that you faced and how would you encourage someone else who would be interested in pursuing this type of work? You know,
there are ways to do it. But the way I do it is especially hard. You could do it with a lot less stress, with a lot less fewer expectations. But I'll tell you that the hardest thing for me to do was to work with students of color. Because when I started the first study abroad, it was predominantly people of African American descent. And that alone was hard to get that population of students to believe that travel was part of the agenda of the University of Michigan. That they did not feel that they could go to Africa. They were excited to go, they wanted to go, but I can't go because I don't have the money in an institution that has money to send students to Italy and France and all of these places. Those students would think that way. So they were outside the system. When university talks about diversity, it's in these small details that diversity does not happen. And so when I was taking students, African-American students to Africa or to the Caribbean or so forth, each of them had to find a hustle to get funding. And I also had to find a hustle within the university to try and find funding for them. I remember you were on a trip one year when I couldn't get money from the department. They weren't able to send the money because at that time, it was like I was a crazy person trying to do this thing. And I borrowed money from my friends in South Africa to pay you all, give you all money. You remember that? The bus had to stop someplace and somebody had to meet me and so forth. I got the money when I came back, but it was not treated as a legitimate program of the university because it was some black people doing some black in some Africa doing this stuff, and you know, and it was not taken seriously. I don't think people in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies, CASIT, and many of the people thought it was like a niche little thing. It was not taken seriously. And so I think it's not only in the university, but within the department itself. I remember one year asking for $2,000 that I could go for my ticket to South Africa, and it was denied. So if you want me to talk the truth, I'm going to say that stuff. So all of those were the obstacles. But in addition to that, it was hard for me because I insisted that students of color be involved in the travel. Because one of my missions was to get more African Americans to become sophisticated people in the world. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Okay. There you are.
To become sophisticated people of the world, to know things other than just their neighborhoods. So I remember the first time I was trying to take kids there. You remember Phyllis?
Oh, yeah.
Phyllis. Elizabeth. I remember trying to make my money. She was kind of going around selling bottles,
right?
To get money and can, so she could get money to go. I mean, these are all little details about it. Also, I remember parents coming to me and asking me questions like, where are they going to stay? Are they going to be attacked by lions? Is there an airport there? The education, the awareness. And this was not like 100 years ago. This was in the 2000s, you know. Right. So the work with the parents itself was very important. It's changed now a lot. I mean, there was GIU, which no longer exists. There's now, what is it called now?
CGIS.
So, and it's a whole different system and so forth and so forth. But the struggle to do that, which I think with GIU and so forth, was one of the foundational principles of what CGIS is now, comes from the work of DAS and CAS. And I think that needs to be acknowledged. I know that A.T. Miller, when he was there, he incorporated a lot of the things that I was doing in Pedagogy of Action. In fact, one of the things that CGIS is trying to do now is to involve a service component when they came back. Do you remember that?
These
kids would go to the DIAG and try and do something to say, that's my service project. So I took it seriously, but you can't do service as an afterthought, as a way to legitimize the value of what you're doing. You have to do it as part of the structure of the program itself. So it was difficult. So it's for me to do it in the way I have done it. And I require students to I monitor their personal behavior. They could not be disrespectful to the maids. They could not, they had to all take gifts to give to people. There are many, many things that I put in place that were personal. And so I personally was involved with the students. And for me, that was the important requirement in transforming those students into the kinds of people that they are today.
On that, can you talk a little bit more about where the community comes in when it comes to your work and what you teach to your students?
Well, I see my students, first of all, I teach a lot of students of color. I see my students as the front of the community. So I want them to value where they've come from. Like in GCP, like Nadia, she is very invested in her past high school and is developing work with them. So for me, the community and the student together as one. We need at the university to teach students how to not be alienated from their community, but how to be connected to their community. Not in a social work way, but in an ideological, radical way. I don't think that, you know, you're going back to do little projects, but in an ongoing way. GCP has been existing now for 5 years. Which is quite a phenomenon. We don't go in for a semester and give some students some little experiences and then leave. It continues, and that continuation is very important for work in the community. You can go into a community and work for a semester, and the students get the credit, and they've met their service requirement, and then you move on. That's not servicing the community. That's servicing the students. You serve the community by continuing to work in the community, not abandoning them because it served the purpose of the university or the student getting a degree. So, people talk about this stuff, but to actually do it takes a lot of devotion, a lot of strength, and a lot of money, which I always have to try to struggle for from various places around the university itself. And I think the university should put money into those things. When Nadia is doing all this work, I try to find some little pots of funding so she could get paid as a part-time worker. She's not asking for it, but it helps as well. Nadia, both parents have lost their incomes during COVID, okay? And she continues to do GCP and two other jobs. Now that's somebody you want to inculcate and support. So we need to think of these students in ways that are different than just people you want to get through and get a degree. You want to help them to support their ideas. So maybe it's asking too much, I don't know.
Wow, it's so much. You know, I just keep thinking about just in terms of seeing the progression of when I first took classes in CAS, and you know, that same sense of what you're speaking in terms of the community, and the ways that as time went on, Des started moving in other directions.
Right.
I was hoping, could you talk to us a little bit about your first experiences and how you felt Cass operated in terms of, you know, having perhaps what we'd call a smaller faculty, but the ways that you all interacted with one another compared to moving through the years?
I'm not sure what the question is.
I guess the whole sense of it was a smaller faculty, but mm-hmm. it seems as though you all had a sense of camaraderie.
Yes.
That was very special.
Yeah, it's a smaller faculty. We knew each other. We supported each other. We know what kinds of work we did and so forth. I don't know everybody who works in DASNO. I don't know everybody. It's a huge, I really don't know. And I think I think the biggest problem with DAS right now is the larger the faculty is, the smaller the student body. And I think the problem with DAS is how to attract students to DAS as a program in a way that students want to be there. And I think there are efforts that are being now addressed to fix that, but I think it's a contradiction between being a tenured track faculty and the obligations to that versus the obligations to teaching. It doesn't mean that there are people in DAS who don't want to teach. I just think it's a systemic problem within the system itself of valuing certain kinds of student-centered work. And I think some faculty do it much better. I think the support is much easier when the faculty is smaller. But I don't know everybody in DAS right now. And I'm now sort of the history of DAS, no longer sort of present in the way I was before. But I would like to see certain kinds of things continue, but I don't know. It takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication. And I'm not sure how that's going to happen. But, being an academic is a really nice job. You get tenured, you have a job for your life, you get to travel, you got to do all these various things, you get research funding and stuff like that. It's a nice job. I think it's ranked one of the best jobs. And when you rank jobs, I think it's probably one of the best ranked jobs. So, but you don't have necessarily have to get involved with students and students of color and take on their issues and so forth. You can do well without it. So what I'm talking about is not necessarily required of people. It's not required. This is my choice of how I choose to construe the role that I had. And I did it because I loved it. I felt that the quality of my life was infinitely better, and whatever support the university gave me, I was grateful for it, and I was able to do it. And I have a body of students now in the world that are making a difference. And I can say that to me, that's the most important thing about my time at the University of Michigan, is the love I had for my students and the love they have for me. And ultimately, that's what it's all about.
Thank you for sharing that. You actually spoke a little bit about the question I was going to ask later. But before I ask that, I would like to know how you think CAS has done in progression, like with DAS right now. How have we progressed to the objective of its four founding fathers? I mean, I knew when CAS started, they had some objective they wanted to meet.
Mm-hmm. I was a student when CAS was formed. I was an undergraduate student. I was not a leader or anything. I was going to school, and I know there was a strike, and I struck, basically, is what I do. I did. And so I was not involved directly in CAS at the time. I was a student. I was my consciousness was the size of an amoeba. So I was just doing whatever I was supposed to do. But I was at that time a married student, very young, and so I was just like trying to, I didn't want to go to school. I wanted to be a housewife. And I was just going to school. And then I suddenly read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and it transformed my whole life. So, but CAS at the time was a place where students of color would go. It's a place where people who were not historically academics, but really activists and intellectuals, formed a group of folks who stood up, and the students who stood up say, we want a place where Black students should be. This thing is falling down. Okay. Yeah, we want a place that is focused on Africa and African Americans and in issues in the diaspora for students of color. And the people who started it, I knew Niyar Sudar Khasa, Harold Cruz was there, really, really astonishing people of great accomplishment were there. But there was community developed and community based. And the agenda for CAS at the time was to represent people of color and to include students, to have the student body be engaged in those things. And as CAS has become, and one of the things at the university is that people of African descent who live in the United States had to constantly prove that they could do theory, that they could think and they could write and they could publish. And so that activist agenda also became very important for the academics themselves to show the university that they could get tenure, that they could produce the work that's required while at the same time doing advocacy work. And that, you know, it's at one point or another, one thing, one over the other. The system of the university at that time to get tenure was very, very difficult. And for a long time, a lot of Black women did not get tenure at the University of Michigan. And so it was very, very difficult. It was a very struggle. So I think that struggle took over the more advocacy attempts. And so African-American and African studies became more focused on sort of acquiring and establishing the breadth and the heft and the depth of its intellectual and academic strength. And it's developed its international program, the African Studies Center and so forth, really highly regarded and bringing African students to the university and so forth. So there's a lot that it's done, but I think that the onus is to make sure you have people of a certain level of intellectual and academic quality, which they have, but I think there are a lot of things that are lost in that. And one of that is the activist and advocacy component.
Well, that's got me thinking. Do you think both can exist? I'm just thinking about, you know, other universities and how they often look to our department as kind of a beacon when at the same time we're struggling with that, you know, praxis versus theory kind of, you know, dynamic.
Dichotomy.
Right, it is a dichotomy in many ways, but at the same time, when you think about the big picture of what education is, community engagement is so important.
I agree, and I think one of the problems we're having right now in the world and in the United States in particular is the lack of education in the communities about the political situation they're in. We don't do enough work for them. The academics know and so forth, but we're not connecting to them in any particular way. We need to do more of that work. I mean, the public health way that COVID is being handled is really interesting. I don't think it's still community-centered. It's more university-centered. So there are lots and lots of dichotomous issues. But I do think that the crux of the problem is that the university has not developed a system of evaluating and valuing the kind of work that I do. They value and evaluate a book. They value and evaluate service work to the university. They value and evaluate student teaching, but that's really lower. And so you can be tenured without being a terrible teacher. So, I mean, it's but you could be a great teacher and not get tenured because your book was not accepted. So I'm saying for the university to become a place that is more the kind of question that South Africa is looking at now in their universities about how to sort of engage the community with them is you have to develop ways of evaluating such work and making it important. If it's not important to your work, then it's irrelevant. So it's really, really important. There's no way to evaluate the work. I mean, I could said that I taught 50,000 people or 20,000 people who are impacted. I would think as a general rule, that would be measured as something as important. When they talk about the program in KwaZulu-Natal, they call the UMISH program. They don't say my name. They say UMISH, okay? Mm-hmm. So the university benefits by that. Or if they can't evaluate it, find a way in which they can find a name or a emolument or a kind of teaching position or something to sort of inculcate people like that. I mean, I'm older now. You need to get a younger person that could do the work that I do. But that younger person should not be on the chopping line or the front line like I was, you know? I mean, create a position, create a kind of professorship or a lectureship or some kind of ship, whatever that is, in which you could inculcate people like that and you could support people like that. The university does not have a space in it to do that. And when we talk about systemic racism or systemic hierarchical positions with university, they have rules in the university that would prevent that from happening. And those rules need to be broken. And faculty themselves preside over those rules, and they would say to you, we can't do X, Y, or Z niche because the administration will not allow it. So the administration will not, you've come across that many times, the administration will not allow it because it's not convenient for the administration. We need to inconvenience the administration in those rules. You know, we need to, you know, I cannot tell you the numbers of times we can't do X, Y, and Z for you because the administration will not allow it. Because there's a rule that says such and such. It's an unjust rule. It hierarchizes people in the university. You know, the university is supposed to be a place of equality and social justice. It is not. You know, you are a staff person, Elizabeth, and you do things far beyond staff people. But in the final analysis, when it comes to getting you something, you are staff, okay? And the rules do not allow for X, Y, and Z to happen. And I'm not saying that everything is bad or terrible. I'm telling you what the problems are in doing the kind of work that I do. So if I wanted to do X, Y, or Z, I have to go through the system, and my colleagues would support me, and my colleagues would say, let's do it. And when it comes to the bottom line, they discover that a rule will not allow it to happen. Now, I'm sort of like an optimist, a dreamer, but I would like to see some tenured secure faculty say, that is unfair and unjust. I want to do this, and let us figure out a way to change the rule or do something about it. But that takes a lot of work and a lot of time, and nobody got time for that. Okay? And so what happens as a result is that the system continues unchallenged, unabated. And that's what we mean by systemic racism or systemic structures of injustice, where people who work and serve the university are short-shrifted all the time. Valuable people, important people, and a lot of people of color, and a lot of women. So, you know, look at the rules, you know, look at your rules and how it prevents things from happening. So that, for me, is important. So from the move from caste to DAS, I think, as I said, the activism gets lost. Some people might do it for a while, and you know it's great and so forth. And there's certain things within DAS that continues, but you know it makes it difficult for faculty who care to really go out of their way because it's so onerous. you know. I should have gotten like a semester off for all the work I did, but I'm not allowed to have that.
That's the truth.
Because it's the rules. See? And then they'll say, you have a union. Why does the union do that? The university fights the union all the time. And they'll say, well, bring it to the union. The union at this point is trying to sort of advocate for the faculty who are 50%, for the ones who, for whom these issues are not important. I would prefer to deal with that lack of judgment or that injustice than to have the union shift its focus to something, to me, that is not really critical. But I'm saying at some point, maybe it will get to those things. But at this point, its charge is much larger to see how much money they can get for folks. You know, now the university is broke, okay? I'm not gonna develop on that. That's not what you want to talk to me about. University is broke. And so staff has to be sacrificed. Don't start. I shouldn't go off on this stuff.
Ooh. That's a whole thing right there.
That's a whole thing. Look, I'm a product of the University of Michigan. I went to school at University of Michigan. I love University of Michigan. Let's go blue. But I'm not afraid to speak the truth about it as well. You know, I love the University of Michigan, and that's why I do. I care about it. I care about my students. I had a student who wrote to me the other day, Nisha, they don't value what you do and so forth. You changed us, but you didn't change the university. I said, well, maybe I did change the university because I changed you. They'll take the credit for it. But in the end, that student got his degree, and the shining example that he is one of the things he did was go to University of Michigan. And I happen to be at the University of Michigan. So, you know, it's okay.
You certainly changed my University of Michigan experience.
Huh?
You certainly changed my University of Michigan.
Aw, thank you, honey. That's because you love me, okay? But then I love you too, so it's okay.
That's good. Well, speaking
of Dilapo, are you a student?
I am. I was actually going to start off with that. I am a second year Masters of Health in
You're going to get a public health degree?
I did. I got a first public health degree. So this is my second master's degree, and that is why I'm excited talking to you about how it works.
In which public area? Health.
Public health. It was a general public health
practitioner. Oh, general. Oh, I didn't know they had that.
It was a general. Now I'm thinking of going back to school for a PhD in epidemiology.
Okay, very good. We need good epidemiologists. Not enough people of color epidemiologists.
I know. No. You need to add up kind of gradually.
So I think you should do it.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Too bad if you can't be my student.
I know, right? But I heard a lot of good stuff about you. I heard a lot of good stuff about you. Hopefully I could get to see you around once this COVID thing is over. And
yes, I don't know when that's going to be.
I know, right? Yeah. Yep. All right. So speaking of all the good things you talked about, I mean, what would you think the biggest achievement of DAS has been, like in your own opinion?
The achievement of DAS?
Yeah, the biggest one. I know we've had some probably not too good things, but what has been the biggest achievement since inception?
I think the biggest achievement of DAS is the splendid students that DAS produced, who have been changing the world and making a difference, and who are rounded, full, conscious, revolutionary people. Through the work that Elizabeth does with the BSU, the work on Black Lives Matter, the BLM hashtag at U of M, all of the stuff that's been doing. I want the biggest achievement for DAS to be its students, to be the work that its students has done that's contributed to DAS to where it is today, and who are out front in the world talking about and showing what DAS can achieve. That is their biggest, for me, those students are those students who took DAS when people thought, why would I take stuff in DAS? Because what would a DAS degree get you? You know, and that still exists. And those students came and took those classes and got their PhDs in other fields and have done tremendous work. You know, lots of them, Elizabeth, who are doing tremendous work in universities and in communities all over the world. So I'm proud of those students because they did it against the current. And Das exists against the current still today. And I think that the fact that it exists at the University of Michigan against the current is its one of its biggest and greatest achievement. And I'm very proud of its existence because I'm part of that movement as well.
Wow, I could speak a little bit to that too. I mean, despite the fact that I'm not necessarily a DAS student, but since I came on board, there's this sense of belonging that I got, mm-hmm. just being in that building. I mean, having to relate with people from all over Africa. I told Miss Beth sometimes ago that it feels as if I'm on the continent of Africa, literally.
Yes, correct.
I'm speaking some other, I mean, it's just beautiful. I think that sense of belonging, that sense of voice it gives to Black students, that sense of empowerment was one thing too. I feel that has actually been tremendously great.
But I'm glad you said it, because I think there are few people who make that happen at DAS, the people mm-hmm. whose doors are always open, like Elizabeth, like yeah. going upstairs. There are not that many doors open, but the few who have their doors open present a tremendously important service to those students who are looking for a place to belong in yep. a system in which they feel constantly alienated, sure. all the time. And DAS is that place, you know, yeah. for students, whether they're from Africa or from elsewhere, mm-hmm. there's a place where they feel they can breathe,
yeah.
they can relax, that there it's home. And I mm-hmm. think that on a different scale is what the students need to articulate about as well, is that there's a place where you can go, where you can relax, because when you're a student of African descent in a student of color at the University of Michigan, you mm-hmm. always having a second self, mm. that you have to constantly be that second self all the time. And mm-hmm. then when you go to DAS, you can be your real self.
Mm-hmm. So see? True. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's so interesting you say that, Nisha. That's mm-hmm. so good, because I think that's the reason why I chose to keep my door open, was mm-hmm. because I knew how it felt when I went to Michigan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being in a major that I was the only Black student all 4 years mm-hmm. in that cohort. And mm-hmm. so coming over to DAS, CAS at the time, you know, mm-hmm. in that early 80s.
You can relax, yeah.
Taking a class with Professor Lockhart, mm-hmm. you know, it mm-hmm. really opened my eyes to mm-hmm. thinking about how the African diaspora was so incredibly important to me finding myself as a human, much mm-hmm. less, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. academic, you know, pursuits. It really did make me very mm-hmm. conscious and aware, joining mm-hmm. BSU as an undergrad mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. being in CAS. It really, I remember the first time coming up and seeing the original CAS house.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
the paintings on it. And it just was mind-blowing. You know,
it is important. People don't understand that the things that students of color want is a place where they could feel belonging and connecting. And that's why I think, and it's something that I think the university needs to pay more attention to. It's true that there are a lot of people of color that are being hired, but that's not necessarily the only thing. It's the spaces of comfort and belonging that the students mm-hmm. want, you know, and they need to talk to the right people about that, you know. So, But I think DAS is a place of comfort for students of color is an important achievement.
Your classes were one of the only places on campus where I didn't need to prove that I was worthy of being mm, there mm, mm. as a student. And that's why I've continued to be at DAS, and I've been so happy to continue working at DAS mm-hmm. is because it's one of the only places where your validity and your value are affirmed immediately.
It's not questioned.
You don't have to prove that you deserve to get to be there. You just do because you're there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting. Well, I'm glad, as you see now, see, Arielle is one of my students, see? I forgot that part when she comes back to make these comments. She's been in one of my classes. You've been in a couple of my classes, right? And then you were my assistant for a long time. And then I handed you over to Wayne. Anyway, but now you're making a good contribution to DAS, which is important.
And that's what's beautiful about it. It was so organic. You know, that was a very natural way of...
Because there are lots of other students, like Kelsey was there, so many other people, Rocky, all of them. They're all in the world now. They're doing a good job. I'm proud of them.
Good. And 50 years is a lot of time. In 10, 20 years from now, where do you think DAS will be?
Oh my gosh, 10, 20 years, I'll be dead by then.
No, no.
Ah, I don't want to be a move. 10, 20 years, I hope DAS will be on the front lines of creating a position like the one I've had as a legitimate, tenured, respected position, that they would include this kind of work as a legitimate part of the history of DAS. That's what I would like. That it does not only follow the norm of what academia needs to do, but legitimate ways that participating and working in community can be valued by encouraging young people to go into this kind of field. That's what I would like. So it could be on the front lines of that kind of work. It could be an example. Look, we can do the traditional academic thing and value that, but we could also do the real work in the community and value that. Find ways of valuing that in a legitimate way that the system will recognize and say, yes, there's not a block to that. Yeah, that's possible, you know, that the system can be changed in such a way. I think that would make DAS truly pioneering if they were able to do that. And it would honor the people who begun DAS as well.
Miss Beth?
Wow.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about Professor Afro Lynch.
Oh, yes. We've been on a search, Nisha. It's been wonderful. Dalapo has worked on getting all of our short bios about each of our directors, and we're finding out there's quite a fascinating beginning to DAS that leads into it actually becoming a department. So how Harold Cruz was hired in prior to their actual being the founding, and then how Yates and some of the others were there at the very start, and the heads were being changed, the directors, they found out how challenging it was to run the department. They were, you know, so one of the people that we were having a really hard time with, can you lead us to any ideas of where to find information about Acklin Lynch?
Oh, yeah, I know Acklin.
So that's what I knew. I told him that
he's in D.C. He wasn't well, but he was a good friend. You know, who Acklin was a good friend of Fletcher's.
Was
and Rudy's.
He?
Yes.
Wow.
So I knew him in that group in D.C.
Uh-huh.
I can get you his contact very easily.
Oh, could you? Because we don't have a photo of him. We have no
information. Because when I met him, he said, yes, Acklin used to be at Michigan. He used to be the head of CAS or whatever it was at the time. And I said, really? And I just ignored him because I thought, he don't know what he's talking about.
Nisha.
It's true. Because I'd never heard of that in DAS. Right. I didn't know that at all. And because they used to change people all the time, because basically activists and all these radical people, they know how to oppose. But when it comes to running things, they get very frustrated and upset because the obstacles and blocks are too overwhelming for them. I have a friend now in Guyana, part of the Walter Rodney's party. When they came into power, Rupert, who was a friend of Walter Rodney, he became the Minister of Education. Do you know he became ill? He's no longer able. It's like he went a little crazy.
Wow.
Because all the things he wanted could not be undone after so many years of decrepitness. And I'm saying that story to say that that's the problem with these people who are beginning to run DAS and coming across everything that you can't get done at the university, you know? that the bureaucracy is so powerful that the people who trying to get things done, it stops them. And so I'm pretty sure Acton couldn't stand it very long. I knew he was not well because he had like some knee issues and so forth, but I haven't heard that he passed or anything. So I'm gonna ask Marlene to get me in touch with him. And I'm sure he'd love to talk about it.
Oh, that'd be amazing. See? Because he's just like a big question mark, and we have him listed there, and he's on mm-hmm. the board of directors that we have mm-hmm. hanging in the front office. Mm-hmm. But when we come to find, did he stay in academia? Like, can you think of where
he stayed? I think he went to DC, and I think he stayed. I don't know if he was at Howard or some schools in that area.
Okay.
But he stayed intellectually engaged, but I'm not sure if he was teaching. I knew him for a while, but he was always arguing with everybody. So we never really had a conversation, because he and all of them would go back and forth about the government and the racist policies. The same arguments we've been having for like 55 years. So I wouldn't be engaged with them. Then they would go about whatever. So, but we did interact at some point, he and I, we did, but I didn't go into any conversations about him in Michigan because we were always dealing with the present crisis, whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
So, the conversations.
Mm. Ah, so that's it. Okie dokie. Because we've just been so, it's been really incredible. The LAPO's done a great job of finding so many of the folks like Ozzie mm-hmm. Edwards. Once we discovered that he, when he left here, he went to Harvard. So yeah. Some of these folks had very storied careers once mm-hmm. they left here. But, when you just look for them as they are, they don't come up so easily.
Acklin is from Trinidad. Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. So he and I used to talk about all kinds of stuff, so uh-huh. we never really went back that far with because there's so many things he's done. So, but we used to talk about carnival, all this kind of other stuff. So, like a young lady too. But he's from Trinidad and he was part of I think he took Fletcher to Trinidad as well.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny? They just say that name and I know so much about him.
Right. The world is so small.
The world is so small.
For him to know Mr. Fletcher. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Fletcher knew a lot of people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Fletcher? He was very good. Fletcher was also close with Toni Morrison.
Wow.
And Rhodey's book has now come out again as a reflection. Remember that thing I wrote about Toni Morrison
right.
and Rhodey's book? Now the book has come out again as one of the things that Toni Morrison did. The
wow.
book has been reissued.
Yes, yeah. It. So, oh my.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I think Lois Eric told me that. Lois Eric told
okay.
me that. I think Freddie told me that also.
Okay, I'll have to check because I know I own it back yeah. from. Mommy had it always by her
the
bed.
The other one. The first edition.
The first one.
You have
the
first
yep.
edition.
Yep, yep.
Mm-hmm. I think that first edition is mm-hmm. worth $100.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. I have so many of Mommy's busty books, but
if
I have
you ever need some money,
you can sell it.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry. If I ever have to get, well, that's a whole other story. I got some secret little stuff. I have scurried away in case of
you have your case you have a COVID lot of jewelry too, Elizabeth.
You know I can help you with that side hustle.
Well,
the one who sells stuff, yes.
That's right. But I would never sell like my music and things like that. But I have some music that I could
and Michael's out. Birthday was Saturday.
I watched him all day. It was so
Spike
wonderful.
Lee had a party for him, but mm-hmm. but what's her name said it was a like a DJ thing, wasn't because they couldn't meet. The
That's
people
right.
who meet is people who go to the White House. They can meet.
Mm. Oh my heavens, that's a whole other. Oh, that's just.
I was so upset all of last week. So upset.
It was.
Did you actually watch it? I don't want to give them.
No, I didn't watch it, but you can't escape it. I keep, you like, for example, I'm not watching it, which is the purpose of not spending your time not watching it, which means you're obsessed with it.
Right. But you can't let it stress you. I've reached the point where these things.
Anyway, you know, I'm going to fly back to vote, Elizabeth.
Oh, good.
Because well, maybe by then him. I'll I don't be... trust him now.
Oh, no. He might do anything. He really might.
So if I have to sit down on a chair and move every 10 minutes, I'll do that.
Yeah, you know, I have that little thing Daddy has if you need it.
Yeah, that little seat.
The little, it's like a seat, it's a cane seat.
Yeah.
Where you can sit in.
I'm going to get me one because I'm going to come here and go early in the morning because I went to get my absentee vote, you know. Mm-hmm. Then the lady said to me, she'll post it to Jamaica. I said, do you know what you're saying to me? I don't even know if I'll get that ballot.
She said,
okay, we could send you by email. And I said, what do I do then? She said, you have to mail it back. I said, you know what you're saying to me?
Say it. Oh, boy.
She said, you can send it postage, you know, special, whatever. I said, you know what? Okay. But I've decided since all of that I'm just going to go in line and vote. I'm just going to fly back. It's so important to me.
It's very important. That's one thing I just keep, you know, trying to impress to the students. But so many of them are first-time voters.
They better vote.
So they've got to vote. You know, they can't
have
this
sense of...
they say
they're going to vote and they don't.
And some of them, remember how Shaquan last time didn't vote? He said it didn't matter either way. And he wrote and apologized. Yep.
He
wrote
and apologized?
He wrote me. He's doing great.
He's doing some big job in Seattle or something.
Yeah, and he came out, so I got to meet his boyfriend. So I was so happy for him.
Oh, Shaquan.
Mm-hmm.
We so, have. Yeah. I know that's like two or three people I know in Seattle now. Wow.
Yeah, it's. I would live there if you are someone who likes the rain. It's just a beautiful temperature, and everything is so moderate, and the landscape is just breathtaking with all the mountains.
I should go
volcanoes.
It's now that I'm not teaching, I can go.
You can do whatever you want.
I can. Look,
flip that scarf.
I'm going to tell Zakiya I was a scarf lady today.
Scarf
lady. Did you see what that scarf lady said at the?
Oh my gosh! Oh, I'm sorry, even Dilapo. We took you all off the.
We just having a good time, Dilapo.
I mean, I'm enjoying it. That's okay.
I should have told you when we were talking. Saying Fletcher and Rudy, these are two gentlemen who are just—they were both such incredible men. And Mr. Rudy actually went to U of M and then finished his degree in New Orleans at Xavier. But Dr. Fletcher, he was in D.C. And his son went on one of the Pedagogy of Action trips.
And his with
us too. Yes, who claimed himself my husband, and he's in D.C. and he's a social.
No, he's not. He's now living in the Virgin Islands.
That's right. He moved. That's right.
And you know what? I got an email the other day, and he says, "Hi, Nisha. This is Damon. How are you?" Damon is Rudy's nephew. You don't know him. He's Rudy's nephew. He said he was just looking up at the University of Michigan. That's where his uncle went. Oh. And so he saw my name and he said, hi.
Wow.
His youngest nephew.
Oh my goodness.
I met him when he was a little boy. Anyway, we have a lot of other history. We talk too much history, Elizabeth, you and I.
I know, but that's the whole point of this. You know, as we're going along, it's these, you know, little gaps. There's interesting little moments where we're trying to put together the pieces. And it's really fascinating. It's just now I've created a timeline and everybody's adding to it. And, you know, I tried to put something for each year. So I'm really going back. And now I have my S drive so I can really go back
Oh, I found good.
Some of those things, at least when I came in January of 92, and you were gone, I think, at that point.
Yeah, I left, yes.
So then when you came back, that's mm-hmm. when, no, I did meet you before you left.
Before, because, I was there in 90, 91.
Right, because I remember Devlin and the trip to Jamaica.
Taking my class, yes.
Yeah, he was, he's a doctor now, he's a professor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that study abroad, I remember the photos, and you, I was helping That's archive right. those photos.
What's her name?
Joanne.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, that's going to be my next, this semester. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, in a way, I hate being isolated, but it does help me to concentrate on some of
these. Yeah, give you a project,
Yeah, these projects.
I see all these people.
Right. It's so interesting seeing these people from the past versus, you know, like people coming in the office all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very different existence. It's surreal. But here we are living in the COVID.
That's so true. Mm-hmm. At least we're alive, girl.
Well, after I just went last week and had all my specialists, they checked me. And mm-hmm. my last one is with my infectious disease doctor, because he was the one who got me through TB. So he just wants to, you know, check my lungs, because mm-hmm. One of the complications of COVID is sometimes blood clots.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Embolism, yeah.
Right in your lungs. So he just wants to check them and see.
They don't go, yeah. That's true. You got to be in check. You got to check all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's one of the things I did since I've been here, going to all my doctors, my dentist, my this, my that. It's a lot. It's a big job.
It is. I'm going to stop the recording, just so you all know. I'm going to stop. We were still recording because you were talking about history, so I didn't want to miss anything. But then we
you get to quit.